On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about how Great Britain's agency, just like the NSA, called the GCHQ, is trying to decrypt all of your communication for them to see. Let's see how that goes over. Plus, Brian McHenry, Curtis and I talk with Daniel Law from SAP about platform as a service and how that solves your hyperscaler issues. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 344, recorded May 31st, 2019. SAP solving hyperscaler headaches. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's advanced technology centers like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including OEMs like NetApp. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to www.wwt.com/twit. And by Envoy. Envoy builds beautiful, modern software to help businesses elevate the physical workplace experience. With Envoy visitors, you can greet guests with a welcoming, sleek iPad sign-in app while still protecting your people, property, and ideas. Start your free trial today at envoy.com/twit. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide to this big world of the enterprise. I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need some help from some of the top enterprise tech professionals in this industry, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, you are a happy traveler. You're a survivor of Interop, I guess. How did you do that?
Well, by sheer luck and lots of gumption, I think. It was it was a good week out in the desert. Learned a lot. Got to see some great people, have some wonderful conversations, and actually spent quite a bit of time learning about orchestration, containers, and all things DevOps. It was a good week.
Fantastic. I love all things DevOps. And speaking about another returning brain trust, Mr. Brian McHenry, Director of Global Security Solutions Architect at F5 Networks. Brian, what's been keeping you busy?
Well, you may have heard last time I was on the show was shortly after F5 announced the acquisition of EngineX. And lo and behold, we've closed that deal and we're full steam ahead with getting everybody trained up on all things EngineX at F5. So I've been traveling out to Seattle and San Jose quite a bit. And we've got some travel teed up for Europe and Asia and a few other places over the next few months. So it's going to be a busy early part of my summer.
Fantastic, fantastic. We'd love to hear how that goes for sure. Maybe have an EngineX show. That'd be cool.
Very cool.
But speaking of shows, we definitely have a great one for you guys today. We need to talk a little bit about we need to get on our soapbox again this week and talk a little about how another country is trying to impose on people's privacy. You know, who would have thought that would happen? Plus, we have a great guest from SAP, Daniel Law. He's going to talk about platforms as a service and how it can help solve your hyperscaler headaches. But before we get to all that goodness, we have to jump into this week's blips because we have to talk about those, of course. So let's go ahead and start with that. So each week we continuously hear about new attack vectors surfaced by cybersecurity firms. Now this week we have Andrew Brandt, a principles researcher at Sophos, who is also a sponsor, by the way. And he actually uncovered an interesting one by using honeypot logs. Now, everyone thought, oh, honeypot logs are not great. The honeypots don't really work. Well, they actually do something right. Now, the interesting thing what he found is that in the past, there hasn't been much evidence of attacks on MySQL running on the Windows OS and infecting them with ransomware. But until now, what he has discovered was that hackers would scan for internet accessible MySQL databases, and then they would accept SQL commands, check if the underlying server would run Windows or is running Windows, and then use malicious SQL commands to plant a file on the exposed servers, which would later be executed, infecting the host with the GAN crab, ransomware. Now, you might ask, well, aren't those MySQL servers protected with passwords? Yes, they are, but these scans appear to be opportunistic exploitation of basically misconfigured or passwordless databases. Now, Brent was actually able to track back many of the attacks back to remote servers, which had open directories running server software called HFS, which surfaced download statistics from the, for the attacker's malicious payloads. Now, what did he find? Well, there had been over 3,100 downloads of GrandCAB data in the open directory. And while this isn't especially massive or widespread attack, it does pose a serious risk to MySQL Server admins who had poked a hole through the firewall port 3306 on the database server to be reachable from the outside world. I guess the lesson learned here is stop exposing MySQL.
Well, from MySQL to containers, they're becoming SOP in the enterprise, so you can expect news about container vulnerabilities to just keep coming. Well, and news like this. A recently discovered vulnerability in the Docker container platform could allow an attacker to gain access to files used by other containers and the host server itself. Now, in an unusual progression of events, the vulnerability and exploits have been disclosed before patches are available. Vulnerability, which is designated CVE-2018-15664, was discovered by researcher Alaka Sarai, and it's a flaw in the Docker CP command. You know, CP provides a method for copying a file from the host system to a container. But through this vulnerability, it could give an attacker arbitrary read-write access to the host file system with root privileges. Fortunately, this is not a vulnerability that can be remotely exploited. You'd have to own a container running on the server and then be able to control the code running in the container to run the exploit. That difficulty in exploiting this vulnerability is likely why the researchers and Docker community felt comfortable disclosing the vulnerability before the patch was available. Now, in the hierarchy of things for a CISO to worry about, this vulnerability should be at a low level. But poor patching practices among container developers means it's likely to be that low-level concern for developers for a long, long time to come.
Unless you want your payment card data skimmed, avoid these commerce sites. JavaScript enables many of the rich features we associate with modern web applications in a browser. In fact, disabling JavaScript in your browser would render much of the internet unusable. However, code executing in the browser also introduces vulnerabilities and exploit vectors, such as this one found by researchers with China-based NetLab 360. They found over 105 websites that executed card-skimming JavaScript hosted on the malicious domain magento-analytics.com. The code, unlike that issued legitimately by most websites, is pretty messy and sprawling. The telltale variables the code looks for relate to common credit card tokenization variable names, such as services like VeriSigns. Most of the compromises reported by NetLab 360 appear to be hitting niche sites, but at least six of them are part of the Alexa top 1 million. The compromises reported by NetLab 360 are part of a rash of infections that came to light starting late last year, affecting, among others, sites for British Airways, Newegg, and seven other businesses with more than 500,000 collective visitors per month. It is hard for consumers to detect a site hosted infected JavaScript, and as mentioned, nearly impossible to block JavaScript altogether. Many endpoint security and anti-malware tools will pick up calls to known malicious domains like Magento Analytics. For a full list of sites, head over to NetLab 360 site linked in the Ars Technica article.
Now, insurance is another part of the industry where you don't really hear a lot about attack vectors or people losing data for their customers. Why? Well, I really have no idea, because these companies, they house massive amounts of personal data and they don't always follow standards to protect it. Well, it seems this past month we might have one data leak for the books. According to Brian Krebs, First American Financial Corp, a company that primarily works in real estate insurance, has left as many as 885 million records exposed on its website. What was so ridiculous about this find was the way the data was exposed. Now, if you had a URL for any document in its website, you could simply just add or subtract one number to it on the URL to actually access another document. What? Just add a digit and get someone else's data? Novel idea. Well, what data was exposed, we ask? Well, so security numbers, driver license numbers, driver licenses, account statements, and even internal corporate documents of small businesses. Now, to look on the bright side, it's not clear if someone actually stole all the data on the site maliciously, but lots of private data is actually accessible behind URLs, usually that aren't password protected, but are kept safe because of their URLs are complicated and unguessable. It's the whole concept of security by obscurity, I guess. Google Photos actually, for example, shares images this way. It doesn't work, folks. Don't do it. First America did respond and close down that part of their site while they hired an outside forensics firm to investigate. Do us all a favor, organizations, and just protect our data, please.
Hey, sports fans, there's a new number one on the malware hit parade. Emotet. A form of malware previously classified as a banking Trojan, but now considered a botnet, made up 61% of all malware payloads in the first quarter of 2019, according to researchers at Proofpoint. Researchers who have been tracking Emotet's evolution say its popularity is reflected in the growth of attacks using malicious URLs. Now, in the first quarter of 2019, emailed cyber attacks using bad links outnumbered those packing malicious attachments by 5-1, up 180% from the first quarter of 2018. Emotet frequently downloads additional modules for sending spam and downloading additional malware, and this caused a change in classification, as well as increases in the volume of messages trying to install Emotet. As a result, researchers saw a significant change in the volume of messages by malware family. 61% of payloads were botnets, and all of those were Emotet. Banking Trojans made up 21% of malicious payloads in the first quarter of 2019, mostly driven by Iced ID, The Trick, Qbot, and Ursniff. Emotet's shift away from banking caused the banking Trojan count to fall, but combined with Emotet, the two categories, botnets and banking Trojans, comprised 82% of email-borne malware. Now, researchers report that engineering, automotive, and education industries are the most frequently targeted by email fraud, and across all industries, targeted businesses were hit with an average of 47 emailed attacks in the quarter. And if you're keeping score, payment was the top subject line in email fraud attacks. And that's up a big 6 percentage points from the previous quarter.
Attackers actively exploiting WordPress plugin flaws to send visitors to bad sites. WordPress is a great platform to publish professional-looking websites and is massively popular among blog and commerce sites, among many other types of web properties. Due to many vulnerabilities and its popularity over time, the WordPress platform has become a target for many attacks. In fact, I use it as a honeypot in my own lab. In recent years, auto-patching of WordPress has reduced the attack surface of the platform significantly. But the part of the WordPress platform that makes it so easy to offer advanced functionality is the plugin ecosystem. Not all plugins are well maintained, unfortunately, and attackers have been actively exploiting a recently patched vulnerability in some plugins that causes sites to redirect to malicious sites or display misleading pop-ups, security researchers from Zscaler's Threat Labs warned Wednesday. This vulnerability works by tricking an admin of the popular CMS platform to click a link which injects a malicious JavaScript, note a trend here from my previous report, which then redirects visitors to malicious sites. Due to the plugin nature of the vulnerability, it can also affect other CMS platforms such as Drupal using the same plugins. Researchers from the Zscaler's Threat Lab say attackers are exploiting the vulnerabilities to cause sites using unpatched versions of the WP live chat support to redirect malicious sites or display these unwanted pop-ups. While the attacks aren't widespread, there have been enough of them to raise concern. Whois records show that the domain was registered on May 16th. That's one day after the WP live chat support developers released version 8.0.27, which fixed the vulnerability. Shrotriya published a list of 47 sites he said has been hit by the exploit. While some caused malicious redirects, others didn't and reported they were using unpatched versions of the plugin.
As a reminder, WordPress is also a sponsor of Twit. Now, you go into a restaurant, you buy yourself a burger and fries, and you live in bliss as you stuff your face with comfort food. But what if I told you that the data that you that was also leaked when you went out and actually paid for that burger? Well, that's exactly what Checkers and Rally's drive-thru restaurant have found over this past month. Now, 15% of their locations across the U.S. has been hit with POS malware, which comes out to around about 102 sites in that area. Now, the security incident stemmed from cyber criminals breaching Checkers systems and installing malware on the point of sale systems across more than over 100 of its stores. Now, what did the malware do, you ask? Well, it was designed to collect data stored on magnetic stripe of payment cards, including cardholder name, payment card number, card verification code, and the expiration date. Now, the incident impacted 102 storage checkers across 20 states, which were all exposed at varying times, including as early as December 2015 to as recently as April 2019. Now, conveniently, Checkers has placed a full list of impacted stores on its Checkers data breach security advisory page. I bet you you look for that burger joints page all the time. But while Checkers did not specify when it first discovered the POS malware, it said it worked closely with third-party security experts to contain and remove the malware. Now, POS malware targets point-of-sale terminals and controllers and enable remote attacks against card-present retail transactions when they're conducted. Now, according to Verizon's data breach investigation report, there has been actually a continual reduction in breaches involving point-of-sale environments and card skimming operations. Now, last year, POS malware was found impacting about 160 Applebee's stores across the U.S. Other affected stores have included fashion retailer Forever 21 and Intercontinental Group, which said their payment card systems had been breached. The Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos franchise also was stung by POS malware that managed to infect the chain's inventory management SaaS application. Now, what is the cost of the decrease? Well, it seems that EMV compliance regulation, which provides additional security for card-present transactions, it's actually working. Who would have thought? Regulations, a novel idea. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Worldwide Technology. Now, WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center, or ATC, about 10 years ago, and it's really kind of grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab you've ever seen. And the lab contains more than a half billion dollars in equipment from hundreds of OEMs, ranging from heavyweights like Cisco, NetApp, and VMware, to actually emerging disruptors like Tanium, Equinix, and Expanse. Now, WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers actually have been with them for over a decade because they know that WWT is where they can go to get the answers when they need them to make sure their business runs right. Now, their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation, and it offers a bunch of things. Now, hundreds of on-demand integrated solution labs representing the newest advanced in flash storage, software-defined networking, network automation, endpoint security architecture, and more. Lots and lots of great stuff there. And to learn about products before you launch, WWT's engineers use these environments so quickly they can spin them up, proof of concepts, and allow you to pilot using their sandboxes so you can actually confidently select the best solutions. Now, in many cases, this actually reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases your speed to market. Now, they offer lab as a service, or LAS, which is kind of cool, and it is a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Well, here, actually, customers can perform pragmatic testing using the vast technology that they have that WWT has already built. It's virtual, so you can take full advantage of the unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. Plus, WWT engineers work in these labs every day. They beta test new equipment, they build reference architectures and customer integrations to help you and your organization make the decisions you need in faster time with much less investment. Now, later this summer, WWT will be launching a new digital platform with hands-on access to more than 200 lab environments. Now, to learn more about WWT, the ATC, and sign up for pre-launch access to the new on-demand lab platform, go to www.wwt.com/twit. WWT simplifies the complex. That's www.wwt.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank WWT for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into this week's bites. Now, Apple and Google and others are condemning this new secret law that they're trying to enforce. Now, about 44 other organizations are trying to block this as well. Well, what are they trying to block? Well, it all started out with the GCHQ, which is actually Great Britain's equivalent to the NSA. And they wanted to find a way around encryption for services and apps like Messages, FaceTime, WhatsApp, and Signal. Now, why the heck do they want to do that, you ask? Well, national security, of course, is their reason. If nothing else, they have a clever name for it. It's called, in other words, dubbed Ghost Proposal. Man, I was hoping they were more Mission Impossible style name like Ghost Protocol, but I guess Ghost Proposal works. Now, Apple thought they were able to shut down the GCHQ by informing them that message chats and FaceTime calls use end-to-end encryption. So that means that Apple doesn't know the encryption key and therefore can't access the content while it's being done. Now, you think that would have stopped the NSA or of Great Britain? But not a bit actually here. In fact, they may have come up with a workaround that could work for almost all the services' problems. Now, all services have to do is secretly add a law enforcement agency as an invisible participant in chats, and then encryption is no longer a problem. Essentially, bugging digital communication channels with an invisible third party. Now, here's their statement. It is relatively easy for service providers to silently add a law enforcement participant to a group chat or call. The service provider usually controls the identity system and so really decides who's who and which devices are involved. They're usually involved in introducing the parties to the chat or call. In a solution like this, we're normally talking about suppressing a notification on a target's device and possibly those communicating with it. In short, Apple or any other company that allows people to privately chat would be forced to allow the government to join those chats as a silent, invisible eavesdropper. Great. Well, the civil society organization doesn't like that very much. In fact, they put out a public letter to the GCHQ declaring that Ghost Proposal to be rejected to the fact that, one, it violates fundamental human rights. Number two, it creates new security risks. And number three, it also violates the GCHQ's own stated principles. Now, the lengthy letter actually condemns the proposal to secretly adding law enforcement agencies to encrypted chats, and it was signed by a ton of tech giants, like I said before. In fact, other civil rights organizations and security experts as well. So I want to throw this over to my co-hosts. I'll start with you, Curtis. Now, we've seen the likes of this types of proposals elsewhere in the world, right?
Well, yes, we see this from just about every law enforcement and national security agency. Every time something bad happens, their answer is to destroy the strong encryption systems that are used to protect business and individuals so that their job is easier. And it's worth noting that many of the proposals, especially if they come from politicians, show a profound lack of understanding about how encryption works and how communications protocols work. This particular one is fascinating, but for those who say that, you know, this can be done securely, that there would never be any sort of misuse or chance for this kind of thing to fall into the wrong hands, I think all we have to do is look at the range of Eternal Blue exploits that are currently still wreaking havoc out there and understand that no back door remains secure for very long.
That's right. And Bam, I want to throw this over to you because I know we've heard about this in the Australian government. They actually passed that controversial world first law that says it's basically anti-encryption law. And tons of services actually pulled out from the country. Is this a pattern? Are we going to see more of this? Are we going to see more countries coming in and trying to do this to all services?
Absolutely. Right. I think it already is a pattern that anytime there's something that provides really strong privacy via encryption, we see every time, you know, whether it's GCHQ or the NSA or the Australian government, they want an end around, right? They want their back door. They want their way in because there's a perception that this is how bad guys get things done, right? The criminals of the world are all flocking to encryption to have their secret conversations and hatch their nefarious plans. It's all very Bond-like view of the world. I think the reality is that there's always going to be secret ways for those who don't want to be eavesdropped to talk. The reality is that we also, as you know, law-abiding citizens do deserve privacy. The question is whether is it enforceable, right? They keep coming back and say, oh, we've got a way to have a back door that doesn't compromise the system for everybody. But to date, I haven't seen one person with a credible background in cryptography say that this is actually possible, right? I'm not going to sit here and tell you I know enough about cryptography to be anything more than dangerous. But, you know, folks like Matthew Green at Johns Hopkins will tell you time and time again, if you are using, you know, encryption that's well designed to provide end-to-end secrecy and data integrity, then you're not going to be able to backdoor it for one person without backdooring it for everyone. And the government continues to persist. They want it to be, you know, just like wireline services where, you know, back in the day, there was always an operator on the line with you. And time has moved on. And I really think, you know, we need to, as a society, as you know, a voting populace, to say, hey, cry out and say, hey, we deserve our privacy and get better guarantees in the books, on the books. Because although many people like to say, well, we have freedom of speech in the US guaranteed by the Constitution, there is really very little protection for privacy built into the Constitution. And that's something that, you know, whether it's here in the U.S., and I obviously have better knowledge of our Constitution and our laws, but anywhere else where we want to fight back against these things, we need to get better laws on the books so that, you know, the Australian governments of the world, the GCHQs of the world, the NSAs of the world can't, you know, run roughshod over our privacy, because we can't, you know, compromise everybody for, you know, the few bad apples that spoil it for the bunch, so to speak.
Absolutely. Now, Curtis, I want to throw this concept over to you. Now, we know that there have been some questionable business practices done by companies of the likes of Comcast or some of the other big conglomerates that are out there that say, hey, like, in order to make sure that we maintain our business scale, we need to do some things. We need to lobby. We need to do some things to get moving. Do you think that as more countries kind of pull into this and they ask for these things, these laws saying, hey, these services can't work in our country unless you allow us to do this, will services fold? Will they lose too many users and they just say, hey, you know what? It's time to just allow them to do it.
Well, I think with any country, it comes down to a question for the business involved as to whether the business in that country is worth the hit to their global reputation that this will take. Now, in a country like China, the answer tends to be yes. And we've seen companies make a number of privacy and security related compromises to be able to continue doing business in China. If we're talking about, you know, Liechtenstein, then the economic calculus might well be quite different. I think it's interesting, though, to look at this question not only from those who are current politicians and law enforcement, but from those who used to be. Michael Chertoff was the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security for several years, from 2005 to 2009. He's now principal of the Chertoff Group, a security consulting firm. I've talked to him two or three times. And Chertoff is one who now says that he is a believer in strong, unbreakable security, that getting to the contents of these communications is an issue for law enforcement and national security forces to be able to do on their own, that we should not in any way weaken the encryption protocols to make their job easier because of the profound impact that kind of thing could have on economic development and general global freedoms. So I think that the approach and the opinion of someone like that carries a lot of weight. This is something designed to make law enforcement's job easier, not possible. And I don't think that we should sacrifice all of our privacy on that particular altar, either here in the U.S. or, frankly, any nation that considers itself free around the world.
Yeah, I agree. I think, Brian, I want to throw this over to you. When have we have, and we've seen this many times, but can you give an example of when we've seen kind of like a backdoor added for the good guys or the bad guys? We're like, ooh, I see that backdoor. I'm going to use that.
Yeah, well, there's a couple that leap immediately to mind from very recent history, right? The Eternal Blue leak of those sets of, you know, government tools, right? It was a set of tools that was used by the NSA, by governmental agencies. It was developed. It was, you know, they kept all of their disclosure of vulnerabilities they found and ways to exploit things to themselves. And said, you know, if we keep this secret, that way none of it will get patched, right? We don't report it to any of the vendors, and we have this whole set of tools that we use. And then it gets leaked or eventually finds its way into the public domain without, you know, responsible disclosure to vendors about vulnerabilities that have been found. And then it becomes, you know, wildfire, right? Then everybody, it's free game, and while everybody scrambles to patch, you know, scrambles even to develop a patch and then roll it out and then be patched, right? So that's a problem. And then, you know, the other example that leaps immediately to mind is the Gray Key software that's been used by the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to crack iPhones that have been locked by PIN or Touch ID or Face ID, whatever you're using to unlock your phone, right? Normally, the way that normally functions, if you have too many failed attempts, it erases the phone. There's a secure enclave hardware-based security built into the iPhone that's meant to defeat this, but this group is not even a group of hackers. It's a security research firm that developed this tool and sell it, you know, for tens of thousands of dollars per use to law enforcement agencies. Now, Apple has moved to block this, and it's become a cat and mouse game between the developers of this Gray Key versus, you know, the iOS developers to kind of stay one step ahead of one another. But the reality is that once you create some sort of key to backdoor a system, whether it's an encryption system or it's a, you know, vulnerability exploit, once something is out there, it's going to get used by people, whether it's by law enforcement or by others. And there's no guarantee. By the way, you know, the only reported uses we have of the Gray Key software on iPhones is via law enforcement. However, there's no guarantee because it's available for sale. There's no guarantee that it hasn't been sold to someone with less than high morals. And I can guarantee you, my experience is that once something is available for sale, it will find its way into somebody with less than a scrupulous intent.
Absolutely. Well, I think that puts that to bed. I want to throw this over to Curtis. Curtis, you have a pretty good story about how GDPR is being effective.
You know, I do. We're now about a year into the era of GDPR, and it's time to take a look at what it's done and what it's cost. And there's some interesting stuff to be found in both those sets of numbers. Now, one thing is absolutely certain, and that's that enterprises are funneling a ton of cash towards continuing GDPR compliance efforts. Forbes reported that this is actually a $9 billion business shakedown. And there are industry sources, including Ernst & Young and the IAPP, reporting that the average spend per organization is about $3 million, with about half of that still to come this year and beyond. Now, the spending is spread among a bunch of categories, including internal people hours, outside legal counsel, consulting, employee training, new technology, and the like. Now, many experts are saying that the economic impact of GDPR isn't over. You know, it started, we're into it, but it's going to keep going. So what are some of these numbers? One of them is that when it comes to compliance, and that is compliance with security protocols and with economic issues and all that, 38% of compliance budgets in those nations that fall under GDPR were dedicated to GDPR. That's true, even though figuring out exactly how much is being spent on GDPR is tough, because there are hidden costs. Costs related to human effort, and that's especially true when organizations haven't fully automated their compliance processes and data flows. One study, for example, shows that two-thirds of organizations dedicated 25 or more employees to managing GDPR, and 80% met at least a few times in the month in the run-up to the deadline. But much of that early effort is stopgap, because that same survey says that 70% of the organizations indicated that their early solutions for GDPR compliance won't scale in the future as regulatory enforcement steps up. Now, with all the money that we've talked about being spent, in many organizations, we've barely moved the needle on actual privacy compliance. For example, one survey found that 70% of companies can't comply with the level of data access offered to their consumers in GDPR-mandated privacy policies. So they've got the policy on the book, but they can't comply with what their own policy says. And a survey conducted by Thomson Reuters found that 48% of organizations worldwide are failing to meet GDPR requirements. Now, it's obvious that there's a ton of work still to do, but there is some good news. One bit of good news is that the number of data protection officers, or DPOs, has grown with GDPR's mandates. Approximately 376,000 organizations have registered DPOs so far in 12 of the 28 EU member states. And an industry group extrapolates that 500,000 total DPOs have registered across Europe. But experts caution that just appointing a DPO isn't enough, that the organizations have to ensure that DPOs are trained and qualified to address what has become a defining tech policy issue of our time, which is protecting privacy and individual data. Meanwhile, enforcement action is in full swing at the European Data Protection Board and European Supervisory Authority. In the year since the deadline, there have been 446 cross-border cases. And at the national level, there have been a total of more than 281,000 cases, including more than 144,000 consumer complaints. Now, according to some figures, GDPR enforcement actions have already resulted in more than 56 million euros, that's roughly $62 million, in fine. And with all of that, the EDPB reports that citizens, those who GDPR is supposed to protect, still are not fully using GDPR. Now, awareness is growing. They say that it's grown by 20% in the last 4 years, with two-thirds of EU citizens reporting that they've at least heard of GDPR. Still, even among those who have heard of it, a lot of those citizens are skeptical about GDPR's benefits. For example, fewer than half of UK citizens have exercised GDPR rights, and only about 36% say that they trust companies more with their personal data now than before GDPR came into effect. What's more, one survey found that across more than 280,000 global consumers, 55% say that since the data transparency provisions of GDPR were passed, they still don't have a really good idea of how companies are collecting, storing, and using their data. So, Lou, I'll start with you. Given what we've seen so far, do you think it's too early to say whether GDPR has been a success or failure?
You know, that's interesting because I think it's been a success in a sense that it's creating a sense of urgency for organizations, especially global ones, to ensure that the user has better control over their data. I know that multiple organizations that I've interacted with have taken it very seriously. They've put in place new data protection capabilities. They're working with members of the EU to understand some of their regulations and what they need to do for their area. It started a movement. And I think that depending on how you define success, I think that to me is somewhat of a success. It's already making corporations and organizations rethink their policies. And I think that, you know, some organizations are pulling out of these areas because they can't fund that type of work or they don't find it important. And so I think that it's starting to break apart the market in a sense and categorize them as organizations that really care about the global market and care about organizations in these markets that follow these rules versus ones that don't. And ones that are going to be afraid that, hey, if we go global and we want that huge market, then we're going to need to do these things. And so I think in that case, it definitely is a success.
Brian, I want to turn to you because I think Lou hit on a critical point, and that's depending upon how you define success or failure. So what do you think? By your definitions, can we yet call GDPR a success or a failure?
I think anything that you try for the first time is it's gonna fail in some cases. But this is something that's being tried for the first time, dealing with, you know, wholesale new technologies that didn't exist, you know, 20 years ago, that, you know, we didn't understand the implications as the internet came to its current level of dominance and really as almost a necessity, as a utility that everybody should have a right to. So the world has changed so much, and finally we're seeing legislation that helps protect people and helps and really tries at least to understand the landscape. So I think in that case, just by trying, it's a success. Now there are going to be things that don't work, but what we do know is successful is that people that weren't aware of what their rights were or didn't know what they could do, now they're even 36% more people being aware. That's a huge blow for democracy, for privacy, and everything that goes with it. So just driving that much more awareness by forcing some companies, as you know, Lou mentions, forcing some companies to pull out of business in Europe, that shows that people are taking it seriously. Companies, more importantly, are taking it seriously. I can't do business here because I can't afford to comply. The thing that really jumps out at me as a person that's worked in InfoSec for a long period of my career is that they're hiring all of these data privacy officers or data protection officers across the EU and, in fact, across the world. Anybody that does business in the European Union or wants to do business there has to comply. So if you're hiring people and putting skin in the game, and now somebody's job is on the line, whether there's compliance, whether things are properly protected, you're going to start to see action. And that's a huge victory in itself, where they're actually funding these efforts. Whether or not they're sufficiently funded is a whole other question. It's going to take time to figure out what sufficiently funded looks like. But you've got to try. You've got to start trying. You've got to start down this path. And no one was taking it very seriously before. We've seen it in many, many data breaches over time, dating back to, you know, the massive Target data breaches, LinkedIn, everybody else. All these data breaches, yeah, they happen. We get a nice little note in the mail or an email that says, oh, you've been breached. Here's some free credit protection for a while. That's not good enough. That's not, you know, a big enough consequence. And the way I know it's not a big enough consequence, because most of those companies that were breached in the past, they're all still in business and in fact thriving. So this gets us steps down the road to create consequences that are meaningful and forcing people who run these large organizations and even some of these smaller companies to make business decisions with respect to how effectively they can manage your privacy. So, you know, not just everyone can stand up a business and say, I can do business, unless they can prove, hey, I can keep your identity, keep your personal information safe.
Okay. Well, now, Lou, we had Brian here talking about the consequences, and basically that those are good consequences, that we see many American companies and companies around the world deciding that they're just not going to do business in Europe because they can't meet the requirements of GDPR. But we're starting to see more and more both executives and politicians in the U.S. call for GDPR-like regulations here on privacy. It's going to be really tough for a U.S.-based company to decide that it's not going to do business in the U.S. So what do you think of this idea? Should we just do a blanket cut and paste of GDPR into U.S. regulations? Or do you think there are some things that we should take a close look at before we plan on implementing them here in the land of the free and the home of the brave?
So I think there is definitely a signal, right? As Brian and I talked about, like, some organizations are pulling out because they can't afford to do it in the EU. And that's a signal of, hey, maybe it's time that this is working and that it could be time to bring it to the U.S. to then signal those organizations that they do actually have to do the right thing. I think we're starting to see that a lot. And so the signals are on both sides. I think we're starting to see organizations take it seriously and do the right thing and put different policies in place and new technology to support GDPR. But we're also seeing organizations pull out. And I think that that's definitely a signal that it's working and that it could potentially work here. Now, the question of at what degree can GDPR work here? I don't think that every one of the policies would work, but things like the right to be forgotten and other facets of it could actually work. And that would be, you know, bringing it slowly to the U.S. would be, again, another signal that organizations should be ready for the full gamut of GDPR. So I think that just implementing just a small portion of it could be enough to scare the heck out of the organizations that are not doing the right thing to start doing the right thing. So I think it definitely could work, but maybe in a smaller scale.
Well, the one thing that I think is certain is that we're going to be talking about privacy for a long time to come, both in Europe and the U.S. Well, that will do it for this particular bite. We've got a great guest on, but before we get there, I think that Lou has another one of our great sponsors to tell us about.
We do have another great sponsor, and that is Envoy Visitors. Now, when guests visit your business, your kiosk, your booth, or even your event, they always actually have first impressions. You want to make it easy for your visitors to arrive and check in, and that's where Envoy sets up and makes it really easy. Now, it's time to welcome guests to your modern library. Your organization will be ready for everything that comes through that front door. Envoy Visitors is an iPad kiosk that makes workplaces more efficient. Now, when you see this thing in action, you will actually understand why a ton of businesses are actually using it. In fact, I actually went and visited some friends at a couple local companies recently, like the first one being Splunk, actually. I got an email from them asking me to pre-register. I didn't know what that was, but then I got there and I walked up to the kiosk, entered my name and some of my information. In fact, it took a picture of me, of my beautiful face, my beautiful mug. And a minute later, I had a badge that came out and my buddy came out. And we had lunch together. Now, that was super easy to do. Now, the second time I used Envoy, I actually was at Stripe, and you know, that tech company that actually helps organizations handle payments. And I visited a friend there, and they sent me an email saying, hey, why don't you pre-register? And this time I actually followed that link, put my details in. And after that, I was done. I was given a QR code. And when I got there, I pulled out my phone. They scanned my QR code, took my photo, and bam, I was done. Easy. So cool. Really cool. Now, that's exactly how Envoy Visitors works. When visitors arrive, they sign in on an iPad kiosk, they enter their details, they can even sign any legal documents like NDAs right there on the iPad. You just use your finger and away you go. And Envoy notifies their host. It automatically alerts people when guests arrive. It really saves you time and hassle. In fact, the receptionist didn't really have to do anything. I think they're the ones that handed me the sticker with my face on it. Now, your employees really know who's coming, when they're coming. It makes those awkward kind of meetings that a thing of the past, because you don't have to worry about not knowing when somebody's there or if they're even coming. Now, having a customer partner meetings all the time, I can tell you that having a system like Envoy Visitors really streamlines the process and makes it easy. You walk up, you sign in. Super easy. Boost your office efficiency with smart security that doesn't intimidate your guests. There's no more paper logbook. It doesn't really provide any real value. It's sign in, unlimited visitors, print customized badges, send alerts to when VIPs arrive. It even notifies administrators about unattended guests, so people that shouldn't be there. You can integrate it with your existing systems like Wi-Fi access, ID checks, and emergency notifications, and it will add to your security perimeter and strength. Plus, you'll have all the data on all the visitors in your office, so you know who's coming, when they're on site, and who they're meeting and why. Now, Envoy Visitors works with the tools you're already using, such as Active Directory, Slack, Okta, OneDrive, Skype, Box, Salesforce Chatter, just to name a few there. And if you have your favorite pre-existing system, check out envoy.com/twit to see if they have an integration for you. Plus, they also have a great API, because if you don't, they don't have that integration, you could just go ahead and implement it as well. Now, they're designed to help companies of all types, including those who are highly regulated industries, to meet security and compliance requirements as well. Join companies like Nike, Pinterest, and Spotify that have worked with Envoy to welcome over 30 million visitors. Protect your people, property, and ideas the welcoming way with Envoy. See why 10,000 workplaces worldwide choose Envoy to make a great first impression. Go to envoy.com/twit and start your free trial today. That's envoy.com/twit. And we thank Envoy for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show, where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the TWiET riot. And today we have Daniel Law, Vice President of Product Marketing at SAP. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lou. Glad to be here.
Now, our audiences love to hear origin stories. Can you give the folks at home a little sneak peek into your journey through the industry and what brought you to actually SAP?
Well, that's kind of crazy. So I'm not a young guy. I started out with IBM, and I was in IBM research, did some research around DB2 and some of the distribution products that IBM had, and then got into the software world with Ingress, and worked for a couple of database companies and some tools companies, and was at Sybase for a number of years. And then in 2010, SAP bought Sybase, and we've added to their database portfolio, added a lot of IP into the HANA system and a lot of expertise into database and making HANA the great product that it is. So that's my journey. A longtime database guy. So that's where we are today.
Fantastic. Now, we have a ton of topics to talk about today, especially PaaS services and how they're making things easier. But I want to say to you, what would you say maybe the greatest challenge today in enterprise computing related to hyperscale dominated world? What are organizations running into? How are they making do?
You know, before we do that, I think the GDPR topic is really, really critical. And I thought it was a really interesting discussion you guys had. And SAP, as you know, is a European-based company. And there are some very, very stringent requirements around GDPR. We had to do a lot of work within the company to prove that we are GDPR compliant and really scrub and re-register a lot of our customers and prospects and users to meet those GDPR requirements. And I actually am a big supporter of that personally. I think data security and our information belongs to us, the individual. And I'm glad that GDPR was forcing the issue. And if we roll that then into a PaaS discussion, Lou, the question you actually asked is, we actually provide PaaS services for helping customers and vendors become GDPR compliant. So databases for who customers are, allowing them to manage their own information, that kind of thing. But GDPR, big issue. And I hope that the U.S. Takes up the banner and does some things as well around this topic.
I agree. Yeah, so I want to go back to it because I think one question you kind of went say, hey, organizations can definitely move to PaaS. That is helping. But what do you think that from a challenge perspective from organizations, like people, obviously organizations, they want to scale quickly. They want to move up. They want to scale up and scale out very quickly. Is PaaS the answer? And what are they trying to solve here? What parts of the system and what parts of their software?
Well, I think PaaS as a category has really come because companies want to become more agile. And I think PaaS is one path and one way to do that. Being able to go to a public service provider or other providers, pick up a service, start developing that service, start developing an application and deploying that application quickly. It all ties into agility, into DevOps, into getting applications built and deployed more quickly. And we at SAP, we have embraced that as well. And in fact, we have our own PaaS offering that allows customers to do that. And we've seen some successes with that, pretty amazing, where we've seen customers extend SAP systems that took them 2 years and $2 million to implement with new PaaS services, where they're adding new capabilities using PaaS services to their ERP systems in weeks or months versus years. So in answer to your question, I think it's all about agility. It's all about quickness. It's all about getting something done much more quickly, making IT the group that can do as opposed to the group that, as we used to say, we're nicknamed Dr. No.
So we talked about how organizations, they want to scale, they want to move to the cloud, they are using PaaS services to do it. Now, one thing you kind of interesting thing that you brought up is the fact that they may be using multiple hyperscale provider solutions. So what are some of the issues that are starting to kind of rear their ugly head when it comes to doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lou. And we see a lot of our customers, at least, looking to utilize AWS or Azure, GCP, or other public cloud providers. And at first, it looks really easy to use their PaaS services. But pretty quickly, as they start using services, scaling the services, they realize two things. First of all, that pay-per-use gets really expensive with the hyperscaler as they're utilizing it. And secondly, the services that the hyperscaler provides them is specific to that hyperscaler and not portable to other hyperscalers. And we're finding that many of our customers, especially our large customers, are implementing across at least two, many times three hyperscalers for their applications, and they're not able to manage the applications built on each one of those hyperscalers. So they become kind of islands of automation, again, if you will, kind of the classic IT problem where you develop an app and that lives in its own island. So we're finding customers saying, oh man, I've got my AWS developers, I've got my Azure developers, I've got my GCP developers, and they're all doing different things. So the cost is high over time as you scale, and you have to get specialized resources across each one of those hyperscalers. So those are the two big things that we see. Hear from our customers, at least.
Makes sense. Now, maybe you can kind of go over a little bit and describe how SAP kind of approaches to cloud computing architectures and platform services. How are they solving things by using those?
Yeah, so we offer our own platform services, our cloud platform services, and the name of that set of services is called SAP Cloud Platform. And it looks and feels just like a hyperscaler. And in fact, it runs on the hyperscalers. So we have a portable set of services for things like integration, API management, API connection, database services, mobility services, all kinds of other services that actually run on top of the platform of choice, the hyperscaler of choice, for the customer. So if they are, let's say, an AWS customer, cloud platform can be utilized to extend SAP or other applications on an AWS infrastructure. Similarly for Azure, similarly for GCP. If the customer has all three, they can be running cloud platform in across all three of those architectures, but getting common services from SAP across those. So it prevents the lock-in of the hyperscalers, and we actually do the work to manage the portability across all of those hyperscalers. Does that make sense, Lou?
That makes sense. And I think one question to you, kind of back to you, is maybe can you go over the value of the business application, business platform services?
Yeah, and I think that's the way that we differentiate from the hyperscalers. Really, their strategy is to make their IaaS, their hardware layer, sticky by adding platform services. We have a much different approach. It's our idea to get much, much closer to the application services. So we want to be able to extend an SAP application with a business workflow. We provide a connector to the SAP system. We then add a workflow to it, and it can be automatically extended in the space of a week or two through the workflow service that we provide. Similarly, if you want to add an integration service to connect, let's say, our ERP system to Salesforce.com, the pipeline system, we easily have connectors to be able to pull those together so you can go from demand chain to supply chain very, very quickly.
That makes sense. So you're basically providing a way for developers to build smaller services, smaller applications that integrate into the bigger ones and still provide kind of like incremental value to those systems. Is that basically what you're trying to do?
Yeah, and from an enterprise standpoint, that the real differentiator we provide is these are all enterprise-connected applications. Again, one other thing we hear from, and we talk to our analysts about this, is we see the hyperscalers building small applications, but they're disconnected from the rest of the enterprise. And that is anathema to SAP. So we want to take whatever applications customers have, extend those, so that what you're building on the platform, it becomes the part of the warp and woof of all the applications you're building across the enterprise. They're not islands of automation or islands of applications. So we want to tie in with cloud platform using the services into the services that customers have across the enterprise. And again, do that in a very agile way so that they can extend applications very quickly. Good example of that is we have lots of customers who have specific reporting requirements that are different country by country, especially in Latin America. Well, instead of building an application each time, we just take the ERP application, add a specific extension country by country, which is a pretty simple workflow, and we get that done for each country in about 2 to 3 weeks. And now the company can go on and do the reporting specific to each country in Latin America.
Fantastic. So what about organizations that are trying for digital transformation? How can the business platform help these enterprise companies?
Yeah, we've got some really cool companies doing digital transformation. And to me, digital transformation is tied up with this agile DevOps, fail quickly kind of methodology. And I'll just give one example of that. And there's a company called Bumblebee Seafoods. If you've ever bought their tuna, you know who they are. Well, they want to be the leader in making sure that everything is ethically sourced. So they're actually using a blockchain service from SAP that is, whenever they tag the fish, they scan the fish that it most times is line caught from a tuna perspective. They tag the fish, they scan it on the boat. Then once it goes into the process through blockchain, they are tracking that fish and all the pieces of that fish that are used for consumption all the way to the can that you buy at the supermarket. At the supermarket, you actually scan a QR code that will tell you exactly the place where that fish was caught with what type of line and what type of hopefully ethical process from line to can. that went through. And that's all using blockchain technology. And Bumblebee wants to be the leader in ethically sourced seafood across the world. What a great way to do that, through a QR code on the can that gives you a view back into an application that shows you how they're being ethically caught and processed. Pretty cool.
Very cool. Now, I do want to throw a scenario at you. Maybe you can describe whether this can be helped. So we have lots of organizations today that are using, let's say, an SAP Enterprise Resource Planning or ERP software, and it works on an Oracle database. It's on-prem, but they want to migrate that to the cloud. They want to migrate it. They want to maybe move to SAP HANA or SAP SQL anywhere. How is this process? Are they helped? Is there an easy way for them to do that?
Yeah, so we've got ERP in the cloud, and that's been very successful for us. And so we have a full motion of SAP S/4HANA cloud, and a lot of customers are using that product already. So we provide a migration path to help customers get to the cloud through that S/4HANA cloud movement. And the second way that we help them, I think, is really kind of interesting as well. Customers historically have used SAP, and it is completely open for going into the system and opening the source code and extending the system, enriching the system. Well, that works on an on-premises environment, but when we are managing hundreds and thousands of customers in the cloud, having each one of them to manage separately as opposed to doing it through a multi-tenant environment is not going to be very reasonable either for the customer or for us as we enhance the system. So what we've provided is the environment in cloud platform, a set of services again, to provide an ABAP environment, which is the coding language for our ERP system, that is separate from the S/4HANA cloud initiative. So they can run their core system on that S/4HANA cloud initiative. They can extend and enrich the system using cloud platform, SAP cloud platform. And then as we enrich the system over time and we manage the system over time, their extensions come along free for the ride. So it's a really great movement. And we have a big initiative to move all of our customers to the cloud through S/4HANA cloud and through the initiatives that we have with Azure and AWS and GCP and others.
Fantastic. Now, speaking of initiatives, I want to throw it over to Bam. You have some questions about an initiative.
Yeah, so we see a lot of our customers, you know, you mentioned digital transformation and DevOps being a big driver and an enabler of digital transformation. Can you talk in a little bit more specifics about the types of things, like if I want to implement SAP's blockchain technology within my application, how do I engage that as a developer? I mean, what are the types of tool sets that you're offering to the developers and to the people that are the DevOps engineers to make this type of integration easy?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Bam. And we provide just a set of services that are accessed through a cockpit, and customers can go in and provision whatever services they want. In the case of Bumblebee Tuna, it was a blockchain service and a cloud connection service to connect up into the ERP system, because part of what Bumblebee did was connect that into their whole ERP system as well. So to the DevOps programmer, it just looks like a service. And that service is updated every 2 weeks on the platform. So the developers are getting new features and functions every 2 weeks that we manage. So it looks like a classic PaaS type of system, but again, oriented toward making real innovative business changes, not trying to make IaaS sticky. Okay, so again, we look up at the application layer. Let me give you another example if I could, and that is we have a company that's worldwide called Delivery Hero. So outside of the US, Delivery Hero is probably the largest food delivery company in the world. They've got over 42 different countries in which they operate, and they bought franchises all over the world, becoming part of this Delivery Hero system. So one of the things they wanted to do was innovate quickly, and they wanted to have a lot of people inputting new projects and capital requests into their systems so that they could fund new projects. And they were mostly development projects to do something innovative, something different, something towards digital transformation in their market so they could disrupt other food delivery services. And they had a process that was mostly a manual process that was taking over a month to look at and analyze and process and approve the new capital spending that they wanted to do, capital investment they wanted to do. So what they did is they actually just built a little workflow system using SAP Cloud Platform that standardized through documents, through a common workflow, through a standardized process for this capital improvement process. And they got it down to once everything is into the system and ready to go, they can either approve or disapprove that in 2 days. So they get over 30 requests a month, so a request a day. They're now able to get back to the person who's requesting the innovation in 2 days. So I thought that was another really cool innovation that they built. And this took them less than 4 months to build this this standardized and innovation for capital requests. Does that make sense, Bam?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, some good examples there to make sense to it. I'm actually going to throw it over to Curtis, who I think has some interesting questions to ask as well.
Yeah, one of my questions has to do with this whole availability of S/4HANA. Now, I've been following SAP for a long time, and I've been going to Sapphire forever. So I have been there for many of Hasso Plattner's lectures on what S/4HANA is, why it's important. And while some of the early demos were done on very modest machines like Mac Minis, for the enterprise, having the hardware to run S/4HANA effectively involves a great big whopping chunk of computer. So are you seeing the cloud availability and the integration capabilities as key to making S/4HANA available to an entirely new set of potential customers?
Yeah, you bet. And in fact, at the last Sapphire that happened just this May, Hasso talked about the separation of memory and storage, compute and storage with HANA. So we've actually re-architected HANA so that we are disassembling compute from storage and adding kind of an extra storage caching layer into HANA so that customers can have more data on disk, bring it up into this caching layer that we call the extension piece. It's almost like a buffer cache on disk, and then bring it into memory when the processing is needed. So we are re-architecting HANA to make this so that we can handle the largest enterprises in the world. The other thing that we've seen, and there's two other things that we've seen, actually. One is we've seen our hardware partners drastically increasing the size of the memory capabilities that they're delivering. So Microsoft now can deliver 12 terabytes up to 24 terabytes in the Azure data space, and we see AWS and GCP doing the same type of things. And then we see Optane as a really interesting technology from Intel, where you'll have non-volatile memory that you can scale out separate from your volatile memory. So HANA being the in-memory system, we're separating the compute from the storage. We see the hardware vendors building bigger systems to handle larger transaction loads. And then finally, we see Optane as a big move by Intel to help scale out larger systems as well. So, Curtis, I think you're going to see some of the largest systems in the world moving to this in-memory type of technology. And we're re-architecting HANA with Intel, with the hardware partners, so that we can handle the largest transactional loads in the world.
That's very cool. And I have to admit, I've been very impressed with some of the applications for S/4HANA entirely separate from SAP's ERP offerings. And that really gets me into my next question. A couple of years ago, I went to SAP TechEd out in Las Vegas, and there is the annual competition there, basically a who can build the coolest application. And you have this hall filled with a couple thousand developers. And I saw high school students and even middle school students who had had a chance to sit down because SAP had donated software to their schools to allow them to program applications. And the thing that brought it to mind was that one of their applications back then was one that did a lot of what the Bumblebee tuna application is. It allowed you to scan cans in the store and find out if they were sustainably sourced. And this was done by a middle schooler a few years ago. Can you tell me, you know, first of all, is that a program? I know that Hassel Plattner is deeply invested in education. So is that the sort of thing that SAP is doing to try and help people learn this technology? And for those who might be a little older than middle school, is there a good way for them to begin to learn to use some of these capabilities?
Yeah, I mean, without thumping my chest too hard, those things that we do at TechEd where we lay out innovations that we want to see people come up with, and then we work through our university alliance programs, we work through other avenues down through high school and middle school. And it was so exciting to see those middle school kids win the prize at TechEd a couple of years ago. And for those who are not familiar with this, we basically have a bake-off of applications that have been built. Kids get to, or the folks get to present for 5 minutes, and then at the end we do a big applause meter to see who won the competition. It's just really fun. And when you add beer to the mix and drinks to the mix, everybody just has a great time doing that. So we're seeing, to answer your question, Curtis, we're seeing a lot more investment in our University Alliances program, especially around the S/4HANA program, as that's so important to SAP. But in addition to that, we also provide SAP courses as well through our open SAP environment. And that actually comes out of the Hassel-Plattner Institute, which is headquartered in Potsdam. So Hassel is deeply involved not only in helping to organize what classes we teach, what MOOCs we're going to support, but he actually is a professor for a number of the classes, still teaching the HANA Basics course, believe it or not. So we see that as a key thing that SAP has to do to give back to the community. And just as an aside, SAP is really good internally about ensuring that we serve and give back to the community as employees of SAP, things that are related to or not related to high tech. So for the last couple of years, I volunteered at a food bank a couple of days in May and a couple of days in October. And we had a cleanup of Moss Beach out in the beach south of San Francisco. And I participated in that. And we had another place where we took disabled and underprivileged kids out to the beach and taught them how to surf and to paddleboard. So I think SAP really is a great balance of culture on not just driving the high tech and driving innovation, but giving back to our culture as well. Hope that answers your question, Curtis.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And that's actually it for my questions. So, Lou, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Thanks, Curtis. Well, we've been talking with Daniel Law of SAP. Unfortunately, we're running a little low on time, but before we close out, I wanted to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home and the organizations where they can go to learn more about SAP and the PaaS services and Hyperscale. Where can they go get started?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, my message is this is not your classic SAP, you know, and We're into DevOps. We're into agility. Go to cloudplatform.sap.com. Go to sap.com to hear about HANA, but cloudplatform.sap.com to hear about the Cloud Platform product. We really are doing a lot of innovation over and above our ERP system. So we are innovating there, but innovating in a lot of other places as well. I talked about blockchain. We've got IoT services. We've got big data services, a lot of other services. So again, we're not your grandfather's SAP anymore. Come to us and look for us to help you innovate. Let's define a project together. Let's get it going in a couple of months. Innovate and digitally transform together. That's the offer.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 PaaS Routing Bits. I especially want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host in crime here, starting with our favorite security journalist, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can the folks at home find you and all of your work?
Well, as always, they can find my words over at darkreading.com. I'll be pointing to those with posts on both Twitter and Instagram. I've got a big piece coming up that's sort of the last follow-up of what I did at Interop. And I'm beginning to put together interviews of the researchers and analysts who are going to be presenting at Black Hat. So that's coming up before you know it, and looking forward to seeing a lot of security folks out in the desert in cool, crisp August.
Thanks, Curtis. We also have to thank our other co-host in crime and a security guru as well, Mr. Brian McHenry. Brian, where can the folks find you and what's going on at F5?
Well, as always, head on over to our community site, Dev Central. It's totally user and community driven. It's all about what you are thinking up and innovating with F5 technology, which now includes Nginx. So there's also an Nginx community wiki and places for you to participate and get involved there. And if you're wondering what's interesting and where to start, you can follow me on Twitter at BA McHenry.
Fantastic. Thanks, Bam. Well, we also have to thank you as well. You are our loyal listeners. You're the people who keep dropping in each and every week to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to the show. So go out to our show page right now to twit.tv/twi, and there you'll see all of our amazing back episodes, all the show notes, co-hosts, guest information, all the links to the shows we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful download or subscribe links. Support the show by getting your audio version, video version, HD video version of your choice and listen on any one of your devices. It really is the best way to get your enterprise and IT news each and every week. After you subscribe, share it with your friends and family. This way that we want subscriptions because that really helps support us. So go ahead and subscribe. And remember, if you're going to subscribe and you want to maybe watch the show live once in a while, you can check us out at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is run. We show the studio, all the back scenes and everything right there on the live stream. Plus, if you're going to jump in and watch live, you might as well go and jump into the chat room live as well. That's irc.twit.tv. We have a lot of great characters in there. We got some really great topics and discussion points from them each and every week. So go ahead and jump in there and join them as well. Don't forget, right after this episode of Twiit, we have the next installment of Cheebert's Kitchen. There's some really good stuff in there, so go ahead and check it out and continue listening. Also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There you get to see all of my work that I do at Microsoft each and every week. Of course, go out and check dev.office.com. You can see all the greatest and greatest ways to make your office more productive for you using the Office platform. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for their support. Let's also thank all the engineers at Twit. Especially, we want to thank Mr. Brian Cheebert. He is our loyal producer as well as our co-host, and he does all the bookings and plannings for the show. We really couldn't do this show without him. Now, before we sign out, we also have to thank our great TD for today, Victor. Victor, sticking with the tradition of the show, what was the topics of today's show?
Well, what I learned today was our data might not be safe from breaches, but I can find out if my tuna is safe on the blockchain.
So close. It was really about it's not your grandfather's SAP, but maybe next time. Maybe next time, Victor. And until next time, I'm Luis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hi, this is Chibert, Brian Chi, and this is a Twiet afternoon special. Well, you know, we've had problems with voice over IP, and a lot of our viewers said they'd like more detail. Well, that's what the after-school specials are all about. In segment 2B, we are solving voice over IP and unified communications because they're almost the same thing now, but we're looking at echo problems. Now, we know what echoes sound like, and I'm not, you know, it's when you start saying something and then it comes back at you. So we all know what it sounds like. But Tim Titus, the CTO of Pass Solutions, and I are talking, and, you know, let's go dig into what causes it and maybe some of the history so we can understand the modern causes. So, Tim, why don't we dive in? You know, where did this echo problem come from, and why is it still with us in this digital age?
So really what it comes from is the history of our phone system, even though it's modern with VoIP and UC, is it all has roots back into the two-wire POTS phone system, plain old phone system. And there is still a lot of connectivity into that old phone system. There's a lot of capability that's built into phones, VoIP phones, and gateways to mimic this two-wire phone system. One of the things that they have mimicked is what's called side tone. So what side tone is that when you're talking into a VoIP handset, you hear yourself talk. And what the purpose of side tone is it allows you to self-regulate your volume. That way you can talk really quietly and you can hear yourself talk really quietly and know this is how you're going to sound to the person on the far end. If you shout, you know that you're going to hear yourself shouting. As an aside, the lack of side tone is what makes it so that people don't know how they sound on their cell phone. If you're on a cell phone call and the other person grows very faint, you start shouting into your cell phone because you can't hear them as well. The silliness is they can hear you just fine. You're having problems hearing them. So you're shouting for no reason. So if you had side tone on your cell phone, you could self-regulate your volume. But I haven't found a cell phone yet that has side tone. So side tone is something that you hear locally. An artifact of that local side tone with just two wires of communications going on is you have what's called remote side tone. The remote side tone is yourself hearing yourself from the other side of the call because there's only two wires. There's no separation of transmit and receive in that sense. It's all on one loop. And you end up hearing yourself at the remote side as well. Now, the reason you don't hear an echo when you have that remote side tone is that it happens instantaneously. So the remote side tone and the local side tone all happen at the same time. You don't detect any echo. On the other hand, if that remote side tone was delayed by, let's say, 2,000 milliseconds or 2 seconds, what? You'd hear here is yourself speaking in an echo chamber. So that's where the echo comes from, is when you have the remote side tone have a lot of latency. So you go into your own network and say, okay, do we have latency in this network? And that's really something you're going to want to end up fixing.
Okay, latency.
That's the source of the problem.
It sounds like it's easy to find, but how do we resolve this? You know, okay, let's separate this resolution into two pieces. One, if it's just human beings involved, you know, say it's late at night or something, if you're on a two-person call or even a conference call, what kinds of things can users do immediately to try and get past some of this echo problem?
So you end up making that call with the other person. And what happens is both of your VoIP phones have what's called echo cancellation circuitry. This echo cancellation circuitry does its best job to try and remove any echo that it sees so that that problem just disappears. The problem is this echo cancellation circuitry works in about 90 to 95% of the cases. If you have high latency, then that means that that 5% of the cases where it's just not able to cover that, it's not able to remove the echo, you're going to end up hearing the echo. So in general, if you're on a two-person call, and I think this is something a lot of folks do, hang up and reestablish the call. In many cases, the problem will go away. And you're wondering, well, why did it go away? What changed? Two things changed. Your route path might be different. You might be taking a different path through the network that is more efficient and lower latency. The second problem is you've reset the echo cancellation circuitry and given it an ability to say, okay, try again, catch up, and actually be able to remove the echo. Because honestly, most of these calls, they all have echo. It's a question of whether the echo cancellation circuitry did its job or not. And if you reset it and say, let's try this call again, and the echo disappears, great, wonderful. You're going to be a lot happier at that point because you've reset things.
Right. But what about when I've got like 10 people in a conference call?
So I think we've all been on that conference call where you've got 10 people in there. Everyone's talking just fine. It's all working beautifully. And that one extra person joins. And as soon as that person joins, echo starts. Now, that one last person is the person causing the echo. So if you're in charge of a conference call, what you want to do is watch the order of people adding to the call. And if you have people just adding, it's going to be difficult to find. But it's the last person who joined the call is adding the echo because their echo cancellation circuitry is not working and it's reflecting everything back into the conversation. That person needs to be dropped from the call. Sometimes muting the person will help fix the problem. Sometimes they actually just have to be removed and then re-added later. And adding them later usually causes their echo cancellation circuitry to be reset and it's able to catch up and do its job effectively.
Okay. Now, let's go look at what happens if, oh, heavens to Betsy, we have echo all the time. My users are screaming at me. They're pounding on my door. What kinds of things can I do? What kinds of tools are available to me to try and track down this problem?
So generally for trying to solve an echo problem, what you're going to want to do is focus on reducing the latency in your environment. So the first tool you're going to need is you're going to need a call simulator. So being able to simulate synthetic RTP traffic throughout the environment to be able to see what does our latency profile look like from San Francisco to New York? What about San Francisco to Atlanta? Being able to measure that and have baselines and say we should have no more than 60 milliseconds coast to coast. And if you have spikes of latency where it's climbing up to 100 or 200 milliseconds, you need to be able to talk to your carrier about that. Things you're going to want to do with them or even with your own network to reduce the latency is optimize your route paths. If you're taking routers that are straight across the country, that's beautiful. You're going to have low latency. But if your route paths are going around the southern tip of Antarctica, your packets are going bouncing off of a satellite that's halfway to the moon, you're going to end up having some really high latency. So optimizing the route path to say, how do these packets get from place A to place B and reduce the latency is really what you're going to want to do. Secondarily, you want to make sure that your switches and routers aren't adding latency. I've seen organizations, they have some really nice WAN links, but they've got some 10 and 15-year-old network devices. These network devices are routing packets through a centralized CPU. And that CPU is probably some really old Centrino processor, and it's moving one packet across the network. Now it's moving a second packet across the network. Those slow devices are going to add to latency. If you have really old switches that are doing CPU-based switching, routers that are doing CPU-based routing, you want to upgrade those to more modern equipment so that they're only going to be a millisecond or two getting through the network so that you're not creating latency just by your own network equipment.
Okay. Good advice. But I get latency numbers from Ping and Traceroute. How do I justify going to a call simulator? What makes it different? Am I getting the same kind of information from Ping and Traceroute?
You're getting, I'm going to say, mildly similar. So you can use a ping to be able to determine what the latency is to a remote location. The problem is that latency is going to be single packet latency. And what you want to be able to do is emulate a phone call to the remote location, which is a stream of packets. And testing a stream and seeing what is happening to that stream is different than what you have when you're doing single packet testing. Is it incredibly different? Probably not. Is it different enough that it makes a difference for voice? I would say yes, because single packet latencies might end up showing some really nice numbers. But for a stream, that stream might be slightly different and different enough that it makes a difference for voice.
Well, we've talked about all kinds of things. You know, what can we do to solve echo problems? We've talked about a few of the tools. Let's summarize, Tim. What kinds of things, what kind of best practices should we be doing before we go to our boss asking for a copy of TotalView?
Well, it's know your network. Again, I think we talked in the previous one about having a good network diagram, a good map, an understanding of your network, an understanding of your network equipment. What are the models? What are the manufacturers? How old is this equipment? I think that's the good first best practice for understanding your network and being able to measure what is your latency to that far end of the network. If you don't have the ability to get a troubleshooting solution like our product TotalView, then using the occasional ping or set up a continuous ping. Honestly, a continuous ping to a remote location doesn't take much bandwidth. And so if you set that up, you can end up having that go on for days or weeks and be able to say, gee, if we look at that, the results of that ping or trace route over the previous 6 days, the latency on average was about 40 milliseconds. But if you look at it over the past 2 hours, that latency has been up in the 200 milliseconds. You now know that something has changed. So there are the ability to use free tools to be able to help solve these problems. And latency is one that I think Ping would be a pretty good replication of it. Just recognize that it's not necessarily exacting enough to really get VoIP. What I mean is, if you have ping that shows ping seems to be good, it might be marginal, but ping's not going to show it. And it's those marginal cases where you have to be careful.
Well, we've been talking to Tim Titus of CTO Pass Solutions, and we've been talking about solving echo problems with voice over IP. And of course, unified communications is voice over IP. So we kind of put VoIP/UC. Well, this has been a Twiat after school special, and we're talking VoIP. Next time, we're going and talking about what to do about one-way audio problems in your VoIP system. See you next time.